the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Lots to cover tonight. Well, Private Jessica Lynch, remember her? Well, she has now criticized the military for exaggerating accounts of her rescue and recasting her ordeal as patriotic fable. Asked by ABC News anchor Diane Sawyer if military's portrayal of the rescue bothered her, Lynch said, yeah, it does. It does that they used me in a way to symbolize all this stuff. Yeah, it's wrong. Asked how she felt about reports of her heroism, it hurt in a way, she says, that people would make up stories that they had no truth about. Only I would have been able to know that because the other four people on the vehicle aren't here to tell the story. So I would have been the only one to be able to say, yeah, I went down shooting, but I didn't. Asked about claims that the military exaggerated danger of the rescue mission, she said, yeah. I don't think it quite happened that way. She did admit that she was sexually abused by her captors, but continually said that things just didn't happen the way they did. As a matter of fact, they said her rifle, she said her rifle jammed when the Iraqis were coming at her. She got down on her knees to start praying. So sometimes things just aren't what they appear to be, are they? His name is David Icke, and he's a former professional soccer player, journalist, network anchorman with the BBC. He was the spokesman in the 1980s for the British Green Party, and since 1990, a full-time investigator into who and what is really controlling the world. He's the author of 14 books, including Alice in Wonderland and the World Trade Center Disaster, and his latest book, Tales from the Time Loop. David Icke says the current events in Iraq, for example, are being orchestrated by the very forces that he has been exposing for 13 years and has nothing to do with the liberation of people. It is, he says, about global conquest and control. Tonight on Coast to Coast, David Icke, and we will talk with David about many things. David, welcome back to Coast to Coast. How are you?
Thank you, George. I'm good, mate. I'm just getting the sleep out of my eyes.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, the sun come up, yeah, but I'm good.
You're in England now?
I am, yeah.
Where they're predicting possibly a new ice age underway. I just wanted you to be one of the first to know that out there.
I better put the heating up then, George.
You better. You better indeed. What have you been doing lately?
Well, I've been finishing Tales from the Time Loop. And then, frankly, over the last few weeks, I've been so exhausted after all these 14 years of traveling and talking and writing and researching. It's taken its toll, so I've had a bit of a rest, to be honest, but I'm talking in Charlotte, North Carolina, in shortly, November 23rd, and then I'm going to not be talking for about 6 months or so.
Well, you probably could use the rest with your family. Just take it easy for a little bit.
Oh, yeah, it's nice to smell the roses, to be honest, but it's only a short interval, and I'm planning a great deal in 2004.
Well, you can always sit around and do radio shows at home, like you're doing now, huh?
Yeah, well, that's the easiest thing to do, to be honest.
That's comfortable. You know, I started the program by reading a story from Jessica Lynch, who is highlighted in your book. And, she claims that things just didn't happen the way the military said they did, that they exaggerated her accounts, they took advantage of some of the things that happened in order to portray this as a dramatic rescue. And she, for the first time, says, no, that's not the way it happened. And it makes you wonder, especially after reading your book, Tales from the Time Loop, that maybe indeed there aren't a lot of things that are out there, David, that are happening the way people think they are or the way things are being portrayed to us, are they?
Thing is, George, what you've highlighted is a very, very good point. I go into the Jessica Lynch story in the book because it is a wonderful example of the Hollywood nature of what passes for truth and information through the authorities. And great credit to the girl that she's come out and said this. At the point that I wrote the book, of course, she hadn't, and I was going doing my research without any comments from her. But it was very, very clear when you just look at the story that the official story of Jessica Rambo and what actually unfolded was ludicrous. I mean, as doctors at the hospital have said, one of the doctors, when they realized that the authorities were going to send Jessica to Baghdad, probably the following day, got an ambulance man to drive her to the nearest American checkpoint. When he closed in on it, putting his own life at risk by doing it, of course, so was the doctor, he was fired upon and had to turn back. And it was the day after, according to the doctors at the hospital, that the troops arrived with their heroic rescue when any opposition, military opposition, had already left. But the bigger point that you raise here is one that I've been hammering out for years and years and years. The bottom line, George, of this whole manipulation is the manipulation of our reality. And what when you put out stories that this happened and that happened, when it didn't, it was a very different story, what you're doing is you're selling to the public a false reality. Now, this is fundamental to the whole manipulation for a simple reason. We take action with our bodies, whether it's voting for someone, whether it's fighting someone, or whether it's supporting something, because of our perception of reality. And therefore, if you can manipulate and implant in people a false reality, you are going to get them to react in the way that you want on the basis of that misinformation. And one of the things that the real focus of Tales from the Time Loop, George, is the nature of reality and how we create it. It's something I've really kind of, opened my mind to in a big way in the last year. And when you realize how it's done, and it's a very simple process, you can then understand why society is structured as it is, mm-hmm. why the information we receive is given to us as it is, because what they're doing is seeking to implant externally a false reality so that we will live and experience that false reality in everyday life. And it's the reality that's leading to a centralized fascist global state.
And it is a very easy process, David, that they can use in order to do this. Because, just as I was reading that chapter, they talk about how ironic life is. I'm reading the chapter in your book about Jessica Lynch, and all of a sudden I'm reading the story on the wires about this account of her denying that it happened the way it did. And I'm saying to myself, what are the odds of that happening at this very moment? Things just don't happen that way.
Well, I tell you what I'm finding, George, more and more with every week and month, is that the synchronicity of this manipulation being uncovered is fantastic. And there is something going on in the ether vibrationally that is waking people up and is creating a synchronicity of exposure that is becoming more and more stunning. And a so-called coincidence that you've just mentioned are things that are happening all the time to people. It's almost like a veil is lifting and some force is saying, look at this. This is what's really happening. And I've been on this trail now for 14 years, and I've seen this process get more and more synchronistic with every year that's passed, particularly now. And it's interesting, we're talking, is it tomorrow they have this thing called Harmonic Concordance?
Concordance, it'll be on Saturday, yeah. So, yeah.
There's a lot going on now, and I think it is going to and is affecting people's awareness in an increasingly powerful way. It's almost like a spiritual alarm clock. People are waking up, and they're seeing things they didn't see before. And the more that I've understood this, particularly in the last year since we last spoke, what we're looking at is mass hypnosis. And when people say, people are waking up, or I'm waking up, that's exactly what we're doing. We're waking up from the trance. Because when you see a stage hypnotist, and I've been to see a couple see this at work as part of this research that's been unfolding. What are stage hypnotists doing? They're implanting a false reality into the subconscious of the people on the stage. Mm-hmm. And then those people live out that false reality. Now, we have in the corner of the room the greatest hypnotist of all, which is the television. And what we're getting through the education system, which is what? Implanting young people with a reality, much of which, when you do the research, can be shown to be false. And all the time, we are getting implanted, second by second, through our lives, education, media, whatever, with a false reality. The Jessica Lynch story is just one but very profound example of it. And with that, we are being hypnotized with this reality. Now, once we accept it, we play it out just like the people on the stage of the hypnotist. So what we're looking at, George, at this time, as more and more people open their eyes, it's almost like the hypnotist clicking the fingers and saying, you're out of the trance. And what happens as a result of that, I mean, I watch the faces of people on the stage of these hypnotists, and they look around, and it's like, oh, where am I? Oh, I'm here. And that symbolically, and more than symbolically, is what happens when we wake up. We start to see the same people around us, the same events around us, the same environment around us, but we actually see it in a totally different way because the trance has started to break, and that's the key.
But
stockpiling weapons. It's not, you know, hanging the president. It's not that kind of revolution. Goodness me, that's just the old way recycled. It is a transformation of our reality. And in this year where I've understood more and more of how we create it, it's not just that pennies have dropped. Whole banking systems have dropped in my head in the sense of how it's done and how it's always been done.
There is something else that is happening to it too, and you're quite aware of it because you've mentioned it before. Not only is there this global domination for this mental mind control, as I call it, but they've also built in a system here, David. They've built in a system where those who are smart enough to see it, like you, all of a sudden, people who come forward with different views and different ideas, it's no longer a part where you can just merely listen to someone and say, okay, that's his view. All of a sudden, you are attacked because you oppose what this thing does. And that's what's beginning to concern me more than anything. It's the person who says, for right or wrong, you know, whether going into Iraq was the right decision. And we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight.
Right.
Because some of the players in it fascinate me. But but you no longer can say, I've always been opposed to demonstration that affects troops. But I've always favored demonstration to get views out. Okay, so we're talking about two different things here.
Right.
I don't think, for example, I think one of the things we did wrong during our Vietnam protest days from people who were in colleges, a lot of those people at that time attacked our troops instead of the idea of why we were there. And that was wrong. But what is happening now is the idea itself is being attacked. So if a David Icke or anybody else has a view, all of a sudden you're labeled as something. And I find that to be very dangerous.
Well, you're right, George. And the reason is this, and it goes back to what we've just been talking about. When you are trying to sell a false reality to people so that they will live out that reality, and support the agenda that you wish them to support, then anyone that offers a different reality to the false one is a danger to you. This is why throughout the centuries, I mean, just look at it. Visionaries, in all their various and different forms, have always been perceived as dangerous by those in authority. Why? Because they're offering an alternative reality. Not necessarily 100% truth and all that stuff. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the fact that the reality that we're sold by the authorities is not the only possibility. And once you realize there are other possibilities to that, then, well, what other possibilities are there? And you start to open your mind. And I'll give you a quote, actually. It's in front of me. Talk about synchronistic tonight. And it says this: the lie can be maintained only for such time as the state can shield the people from the political, economic, and or military consequences of the lie. It thus becomes vitally important for the state to use all of its powers to repress dissent, for truth is the mortal enemy of the lie, and thus, by extension, the truth becomes the greatest enemy of the state. And that was said by Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister of the Nazis. And it always stands when those in authority are faced with people putting out an alternative reality. And so what you do is you create a situation where you make it a hassle and unpleasant to stand out and speak out against the norm.
Mm-hmm.
That frightens most people into line. they say, well, this is what I know, this is what I like to say, this is what I believe, but crikey, can you imagine the consequences of me saying it? As the Japanese say, it's a national phrase there, don't be the nail that stands out above the rest, because that's the first one to get hit. And so this herd mentality is created by two things. It's the bar-bar mentality, where people do not question what they hear and just take it as read, following the sheep in front, if you
like. True, and that happens a lot.
Absolutely. And then you get the few who have realized, hey, we're being sold a lie here, or I have a different view to this norm. And most of them will still follow the sheep in front, keep their head down, even though they don't want to, because they fear the consequences of being different. And any society, and it's a real important point you raised, any society in which it is a crime or a hassle to be different is a society based on psychological fascism. And I would struggle to name any country on the planet that is not making it a hassle to be different, because everyone has a norm. It might be a different norm to the United States or a different norm to Germany, but these norms are policed, not least by the people. Oh, no, you know, he's saying that. You're mad, you're bad, you're dangerous. And so we have these mind prisons in which only the people with a real passion and courage, I suppose you could call it, for speaking out, speaking their truth, actually stand out and say anything against the norm, because most people won't. And it's the carrot and the stick. If you do what the system wants you to do, you're rewarded. Hey, you'll pass your exams, you'll go to university, you'll get a good job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you challenge the system,
you're through.
Then you get the stick. Yes. And, oh, you don't pass your exams, you don't do this, you don't do that. At school, if you write down on your exam paper what the system wants you to say, then your John is very clever, a very good pupil. But you challenge what they say, and you challenge it with evidence and common sense, and they're on the phone. Hello, Mrs. Jones. Your Billy is a disruptive influence in the classroom. What do you mean? He's asking questions. They'll all want to do it. And so this carrot and stick thing, and you see it all the way through society, rewards and punishments, bashes people into line, just like the nail standing out above the rest. And this is what we need to resist and walk through, because I tell you from my own experience, it's not as difficult as people think it is. So often in life, thinking about doing something is far worse than doing it. People sit in dentist waiting rooms, oh my goodness, they hate the dentist. And then they go in there and they come out and they say, it was no problem at all. And yet they've gone through all that agony beforehand for no reason. And it's the same with speaking out and speaking your truth. It's thinking about it is worse than doing it.
And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with guest tonight, special guest David Icke. David, the Denver airport, you've done a little work into that. It is one beautiful airport, but very strange facility. What's going on there?
Well, it's very clear that there are underground bases, underground centers all over the United States, indeed my own country here too. If you're going to keep something out of sight, what better way than keeping it underground or inside a mountain?
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, the first time I landed in America to speak on these subjects was in 1996. They were having a synchronistic night tonight. Was actually at Denver Airport.
Uh-huh.
And I, at that time, I was speaking at a conference in Denver, and there were people there who were speaking about the Denver airport. But I hadn't been there yet, of course, when I landed. And so I had no idea about it. First of all, we're coming in, and I had heard it was a new airport while I was on the plane talking to somebody from the city. And then the pilot announced that there would be a long taxi from the runway to the
terminal, sure,
because of the way the runway was laid out. And I'm thinking there on the plane, hold on a minute, it's a new airport. Why have they done the runway like that? Anyway, I get off the plane, and I must say, it was a very, very weird experience, very weird energy. I felt real strange there. And when I got to Denver, I listened to a lady called Alex Christopher, who was at the conference, who was talking about this sort of stuff. And it's very clear that the massive cost overrun and the fact that they had apparently a perfectly adequate airport there called Stapleton before.
Mm-hmm.
Its location, which is well out of the city in the middle of nowhere, and what other people have said about it actually has great validity. There was one guy, no longer with us, fortunately, called Phil Schneider, who was the son of a German U-boat captain, who was captured during the war and brought to America to work with the CIA and what have you. And a lot of these CIA personnel, they operate in families for obvious reasons, keep it inside.
Yeah.
And Phil Schneider was employed when he grew up as an engineer, and he worked on building some of these underground bases. He talked about Area 51 and Dulce in, was it New Mexico?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then, as I understand it, he found that he had a terminal disease, and he started speaking out about it. And I remember I was speaking in those days to nobody. In fact, later that night, I spoke to about six people in someone's house in New England. And the person I was staying with, this is 1996 again, went out during the day, and I was putting videos in the video just to kill time. And one of them was a series of talks by Phil Schneider. It's the first time I'd come across him, apart from hearing his name mentioned in Denver when I first arrived. And he was saying that he had decided to speak out because he didn't know how long he had left. And he was talking about the fact that under Denver Airport were at least eight levels. And when you you talk to people and you read the accounts of those that have worked in these underground bases, you get a different security clearance, a higher one, for each level down that you go. This is absolutely a magnificent symbol of the way that this whole of society and these secret societies and what have you are structured. It's compartmentalization. You only know what you need to know. So people working literally in the underground bases on the higher levels have not got a clue what's actually going on in the lower levels. And he talked about the fact that these lower levels involve non-human entities, and he talked about seeing them and indeed having a shootout with some of them. I think he talked about at one point. And it's interesting that when you look at the ancient accounts, not just the Native American accounts for North America, but others around the world, they talk about having these non-human entities living within the earth. And there have been tremendous caverns and what have you found. There's one in Turkey which was built, and we're talking in ancient times, so that people could live in vast numbers under the ground. And the way they'd structured it, they had the flow of air going through, so people would have a constant flow of oxygen. So these were very sophisticated. And from what I understand, talking to people, a lot of these bases, when you go to the very lowest levels of them, where, of course, you need, as I say, the highest security clearance to go there.
Right.
They open out into some of these caverns where these non-human entities have existed for a very, very long time. Of course, you have to take what people say about this and, use your own intuition on it, because I haven't been there and I haven't seen it. But there's enough people who have told the same story, and indeed it fits with my own research over the years anyway, that there is a heck of a lot going on under the ground, and Denver Airport included, than ever we would believe watching the TV news.
I've read a lot of your works, David. Your work is profound, much of it believable at face value. Some of it one has to think, and some of it one has to sit back and go, I wonder.
Well, that's good.
Which is good.
The reason I do it like that, George, because, it's like I said earlier, this is about taking control back of our own reality and not having an external one planted within us. And therefore, it's about, what do we, quote, individuals, not that there is such a thing when you get to the bigger level of reality, but let's call it individuals, what we feel is our truth. So I've said to people, if people read my books and say, I believe every word of that, I accept every word of it, I'm the most disappointed man in the place.
Understand.
Because that's not what it's about.
But does David Icke, does he believe that there is this reptilian civilization on this planet, or do you believe in some of the reports that people have given you?
It's cumulative, George. This whole thing of reptilian entities started coming into my life in the mid to late 90s. And it started as a trickle and then became a flood. And you talked earlier about synchronicity with the Jessica Lynch story.
Yes.
Well, that is what has happened to me. I had a We talked about it last time. I had a profound experience in Peru in 1991, and from that moment on, the synchronicity of my life has been unbelievable. Doors opening and closing, and when I go through a door, there is information that I need to understand the situation greater. There's some force involved in this that is opening and closing those doors. And the synchronicity started with the reptilian thing, like I say, in the mid-late 90s. And I just kept bumping into people, because I travel a lot, all over the world, all over America, different walks of life,
mm-hmm.
who were telling me this same story. I then go to South Africa, and I meet a Zulu shaman, Credo Mutwa, in his 80s now, the official historian of the Zulu nation. And he talks to me about the same stuff. They call these reptilian entities in their culture the Chitahuri, which translates, he says, as children of the serpent or children of the python. And then when you look at the ancient accounts, again, the reptilian thing is there all the time. They had the Nagas gods people in Asia, who they said could take either human or reptilian form. And then I've talked to people who've been involved in government mind control projects and who have taken part in satanic rituals with some famous people. And they talk again about seeing this shape-shifting between human and reptilian form. I got a call from a lady who was the head of, I think it's called Parents Against Ritual Abuse, and talked to her, not about reptilians, but about the ritual abuse of children and these satanically ritually abused kids,
yes.
Which there are enormous numbers. And in the middle of this conversation, out of the blue, she said to me, "Can you explain something to me? Why is it, do you think, that many of my clients say that during the rituals they see people change from human to reptilian? Do you think these people are dressing up to confuse them?" she said. And so when you have this, over many years, cumulative a gathering of information from so many different sources, it's basically saying the same thing. I mean, indeed, in the last couple of weeks, I've had a filmmaker contact me who was making a film in Vancouver, Canada, and he said, "I just saw these people turning into reptiles in front of my eyes. I saw their eyes change into reptilian eyes and stuff like that." So when you get this wealth of information from so many different sources and so many different people and walks of life, then there is something to look at here. And I have heard enough and seen enough to be very, very clear that this reptilian aspect, not necessarily the whole story, is much bigger than that, but is certainly fundamentally involved in this. And I would say when you look at the ancient and modern information, it's very clear that this is a big part of the story. And also, you know, what is bizarre and what is fantastic to people is only based on the point from which they're observing reality.
That's true.
And so one of the things I've pointed out over the years is that the reality that we're implanted with through our lives, what is real, what is possible, what is impossible, is so fundamentally limited and so different to what is actually going on, that chasm between what we believe is possible and what we believe is real and what is actually going on is so big that it takes many people a long time, indeed many people don't even make it, to bridge that chasm between what they've been indoctrinated to believe is reality and what's actually going on. And as a result of that, it's the fantastic nature of what is happening against the very limited version of possibility that we're given through education and the media and stuff that is the greatest defense that this manipulation has. Because even when the truth comes out, people go, "Oh, come on, mate, that's ridiculous."
Mm-hmm.
But when you get into, and I'm sure we will as we go along tonight, when we get into the nature of reality and how we create it, the fact that there is no reality in the three-dimensional world outside of ourselves, it's actually all going on inside our heads. When you get to that level of understanding what reality is and how we create it, shape-shifting reptilians is extremely small deal indeed. I have, however, been surprised, because when I came out with this stuff, I knew what was going to happen. "Oh, that bloody Ike's mad. Look at him talk about reptiles." I've been very surprised at the number of people who've read the books and have actually said to me, "Well, it is fantastic, mate, but you know something? I reckon there's something in it. It just feels right to me. So, you know, if people feel information rather than think it from the conditioned point of view, they can get very different perspectives upon it.
Do you believe that they may be extraterrestrial or genetically altered human beings from thousands and thousands of years ago, and they are just the offspring of, you know, the offspring of the offspring?
I tell you, I can only give you the conclusions I've come to from all this research, traveling, information, meeting people, and what have you. There seems to be little doubt that there are non-human entities within the Earth that do operate on this planet in what you might call five-sense reality. But the real core and center of this manipulation of this five-sense world, which is just a very narrow frequency range that our five senses can access, beyond that is infinity. And that's where, of course, infinite possibility exists. And it seems to me that the focus of the manipulation is not so much extraterrestrial in the terms of physical five-sense bodies.
Mm-hmm.
It's more interdimensional. And that when people talk about spirits and demonic entities and exorcising people who have been possessed. Of course, if you look at a person who's been possessed by some spirit, you can't actually see what's possessing them. You just see their five-sense body. What is possessing them is operating outside the frequency range of the five senses. So you don't see it, you just see the five-sense level. And it's just outside the frequency range of the five senses that these realms exist, where these deeply, deeply disturbed and imbalanced entities manipulate this five-sense world by possessing, taking over the mental and emotional processes of people in human bodies, manipulate this world. And the more that I've researched this, and indeed talked to insiders who've confirmed it, in fact, at the moment, I'm in correspondence with someone from a very world-famous family who is confirming to me all that I've been saying about the importance of bloodline to this Illuminati, this manipulating network,
mm-hmm.
and the reptilian aspect to these bloodlines. And when you follow these people in power and royal power and political power and banking power today, when you follow their genealogy back, it goes invariably to the aristocratic and royal families of Europe, and then down into places like the ancient Near and Middle East, to Sumer, to Babylon. And when you get back into those ancient times, again, all over the world, not just in Sumer, Babylon, and that area, but other areas, including South Africa and places like that, as I mentioned with Credo Mutwa, the same continuous story keeps reoccurring.
Yes.
That is of a interbreeding between a non-human race and humans to create a hybrid bloodline. Now, this hybrid bloodline became known as the bloodline of the gods, and this is where we get this age-old belief or claim of the divine right to rule, because of your DNA. Across the water from where I'm sitting here, about 2 hours from here, is the Queen of England in Buckingham Palace.
Mm-hmm.
She is head of state in 2003 only because of her DNA. And the whole of the Windsors and the royal family of Britain is structured in terms of the hierarchy and importance and power to the relationship they have with the DNA of the ruling monarch. Now, if you go back to the ancient world, that was happening all over the place, the right to rule because of your bloodline. And if you follow these families through, they again, like I say, come up into Europe, where they became the aristocracy and royal families of Europe, and then through things like the British Empire and the French and what have you, but particularly the British, they expanded all over the world and into the Americas, into Australia and South America, through the Spanish and the Portuguese and Central America. And when these empires, these colonial powers, apparently withdrew and gave independence to these countries, including the United States, what happened, in fact, was it was a move from an in-your-face overt dictatorship through colonial rule to a covert dictatorship, in the sense that they left out in those countries the bloodline and the secret society networks through which this bloodline manipulates itself into power. And they have gone on controlling those countries covertly ever since. And of course, covert control, the prison without the bars, is the most effective of all, because people don't rebel against not being free when they
exactly.
think they are.
I've always thought of it, David, as the chairman of the board of a company where nobody who works in the company ever knows who the person is who's really the chairman of the board, because they never see them in the day-to-day activity, yet they control everything.
Exactly. What do we say? We hear people say all the time in their work, oh, I don't know, it's come from on high, I suppose we better do it. But the question is, from who on high? Where did this actually come down from? And the point that I'm leading to in terms of the reptilians, George, is this. Of course, when I started to realize this whole situation, the question was, okay, these bloodlines, they interbreed obsessively, they have breeding programs to keep the genetics in the way they want them. This is why we've had this interbreeding between royal families and powerful families
sure,
all these years.
Sure.
The question was, George, why? Why are they obsessed with genetics?
With guest David Icke. Okay, David, reptilians, why they want this continual DNA process to evolve?
Okay, I just make the point as well that in Tales from the Time Loop, as I've said in my previous books, this whole reptilian thing is not it. It's one level of it. There's much bigger levels beyond that.
There's a bigger story out here.
Oh, yeah, and in Tales from the Time Loop, I go into that next level, which is the nature of reality and how we create it and the part the reptilians play in that. And but what I was saying before the break is that I asked the question, obviously, why? Why are these people obsessed with bloodline and genetics? And talking to insiders and talking to people who have been victims of this manipulation, talking to people like Credo Mutua and others who come from their perspective, everything in this reality, as I learned in an experience I had in Brazil earlier this year, outside this reality it doesn't necessarily apply, but within this reality everything is a vibration. And you have vibrational sympathy, compatibility, and you have vibrational incompatibility. And as everything is a vibration, so is DNA. And from what I understand, the reason they're obsessed with genetics is that a certain DNA, what has been described to me by one insider as a DNA corruption, which was done by the interbreeding in the ancient times, has created a vibrational compatibility with these other dimensional entities just outside the five sense frequency range that allows them to possess and take over the mental and emotional processes of these particular bloodlines more than the general run of the population that does not have that DNA, quote, corruption, as this guy described it to me. Therefore, in simple terms, they are seeing the human physical body as just like a spacesuit. It allows them to operate in this world. I got in my mind as I was being told about this, you know, in these laboratories where you've got these glass sort of tanks, and what's going on inside those glass tanks cannot come into contact with humans, or they would be harmed.
Sure.
So they actually put those arms, they work through those arms inside the tank.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And so they can do things while they're outside the tank.
With those special gloves on them and things like that.
Exactly. That symbolically appears to be what this is all about. It allows these entities to possess and work through five-sense bodies, therefore interact with this five-sense world and manipulate it. And then came, of course, the obvious question, because I've asked all the obvious questions, and I've got a lot more I'd like to know the answers to, is why? Why do you want to manipulate this world, this reality? And then I came across an astrophysicist in Italy, a brilliant woman called Giovanna Conforto. And what she said to me, she contacted me and she said, I just want to tell you that between dimensions, between this reality and the next one, are neutral zones, which she terms interspace planes. And she says that this is a zone where they don't have an energy source like a dimension does. And anything operating in those interspace planes, as she calls them, needs to create an energy source for itself. And she says, I'm sure this is where your reptilians and these other so-called demonic entities of folklore operate in. And what they're doing is they're feeding off the energy created in our five-sense reality, and that energy is fear. And when I've talked to, well, so many people about not just the reptilian thing, but all these other demonic-type entities, mm-hmm. one of the common themes is they are like vampires. They feed off human energy, and that energy is fear. And fear in all its forms, because stress and guilt and anxiety and aggression and all this stuff are all vibrations of fear. The fear encompasses so much. And so, in simple terms, if they can structure this five-sense society in a way that generates maximum stress, maximum fear, maximum anxiety, and all the rest of it, they are creating a power source for themselves. And when, therefore, you have harmony and peace and tranquility and an absence of fear, that is their worst nightmare. So the whole thing, as I understand it, is to create a society which turns out more and more of this energy. And interestingly, one of the corporations that I've talked about in my books from time to time is the Disney Corporation. And so much of this stuff is put out symbolically, and the more that I've learned, the more that I'm seeing things out there symbolically, not just in modern times, but writers and painters and stuff have symbolically told many of these concepts over the centuries. And I saw a Disney film for youngsters, it seemed to be. I took my boy, mm-hmm. called Monsters, Inc.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I nearly fell off my chair when I saw it, because for people who haven't, this is the story. In the monster world, they do not have an energy source, and therefore they have to create one. And so they have this power station in the so-called monster world, and the power station operates like this. It has thousands of people working for it, and every day they come into the factory and they stand next to a position, and down will come a door, I would say symbolic of interdimensional doorways, mm-hmm. where these entities can come through, but they're doors, you know, from everyday houses and what have you, all different kinds of doors you find in houses. And then they walk through the door, and when they walk through it, they are all find themselves in a children's bedroom. And their job, working for the power station, is to frighten the child. And when the child screams, they catch the scream in a tube, take it back through the door, and power the monster world that way. And symbolically, that's why I nearly fell off the chair in the theater, is what these insiders have explained to me is actually the game. It's about vampiring the energy of humans. And by possessing particularly ones they have a vibrational compatibility with, these hybrid bloodlines, the secret society network manipulates them into power. And they then have structured society to become a power station, an energy source. And interestingly, you remember in that first Matrix movie where the Morpheus character holds up a battery to the Neo character and
yeah.
says they have turned the human being into one of these.
Right, right.
An energy source. Symbolically, again, that seems to be the case. And so disharmony, fear, anxiety, stress is precisely what they want society to create, because that's the necessity to feed these entities in this neutral place, the interspace plane that Conforto talks about.
If you were to grab one of these entities, one of these beings, David, and slap him up behind an X-ray machine, what would you see?
Don't know.
Okay.
These are all questions that lots of people will ask, including myself. But in terms of vibration and frequency, you would have to take some kind of picture of these entities within the frequency range that they operate. Otherwise, the technology wouldn't pick it up. Because, see, one of the things I've realized through these 14 years of full-time, totally focused research is you have to understand at least something about so many different and apparently on the face of it unconnected subjects that when people say to me, well, why hasn't this come out before? Well, you should have been following me for the last 14 years and you'd see, because it takes so much work, so much study of different subjects, and then to fit them together before the picture starts to unfold. And crucially, it's the understanding that when we look through our eyes, we do not see everything that exists in the space we are looking at. We see the frequency range our eyes can access, and it's tiny. And therefore, outside of this tiny frequency range, this little radio station on the dial, if you like, exists infinity, and therefore infinity of possibility exists there. And if we are going to judge possibility on the basis of what we perceive in this tiny little frequency range that we can access visually, then we are going to completely lose the plot, because this is such a tiny tiny fraction of what exists in the space that we're looking at.
Now let's tie this into the situation that, of course, was the thrust of Tales from the Time Loop, where this group, and there are many out there, love the control. What is it that they want? They've got more money than God, don't they, right now?
Yeah, well, money is a vehicle to control more than money itself. Although, having said that, what's very interesting is this. I didn't realize till I started researching this that the most ancient part of the human brain is known by scientists as the R-complex, or reptilian brain. And when you look at the character traits that this is mainstream science says that we get from the reptilian brain, it is the classic Illuminati traits. First of all, they say that's where we get cold-blooded behavior from, that is, doing things without any empathy with people for the consequences of our actions.
No emotion, none, you just do it.
Now, interestingly, George, when I've talked to people who've researched this whole reptilian thing, and talked to insiders as well, and these reptilian entities do not seem to have an emotional level like humans have. And in that sense, they can do things that humans couldn't do, because we have this emotional fail-safe mechanism whereby we can feel empathy with what other people are feeling, and therefore that is what I call an emotional fail-safe mechanism. It will stop us doing things that will cause tremendously unpleasant things to others. Overwhelmingly, that's what happens. Certainly happens in the people that I know. And the other traits that we get from the reptilian brain, according to science, is an obsession with ritualistic behavior. Now, this Illuminati are utterly obsessed with ritual. Everything is ritual. Everything is symbolism. Utterly obsessed with it, to the point where your jaw drops as you start to understand just how obsessed they are.
Like the movie Eyes Wide Shut, sort of?
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, that movie, Eyes Wide Shut, and that ritual that was going on in that stately home. I mean, I've talked to endless people now who've taken part in those rituals, overwhelmingly against their will. And that's exactly what goes on. They're obsessed with it. They follow the ancient Babylonian and other ancient ritual days, which have come known as the Satanic calendar. They follow these things. It was no accident, for instance, that May the 1st, which is a big day for them, was when George Bush went on that aircraft carrier and said an end to the major conflict and all that stuff in Iraq. And so many things happen on these ritual days because they're obsessed with it. Now, this comes from the reptilian brain, according to science. Also, not just ritualistic in terms of the scenes from Eyes Wide Shut, but ritualistic also in going to the same place at the same time every week, doing the supermarket shopping at the same time every week, repeating behavior. And when I talked to Credo Mutwa years ago, he said to me, if you want to understand the Illuminati, he said, study the reptile. And I've done that. I've been and talked to people who work with reptilians, animals and stuff, and talked about the way that they respond and the way they react, and they are incredibly mirroring the reptilian brain in humans. But of course, in most humans, this reptilian level is balanced out by other levels, and so you get the balance. But if you're more dominated by this reptilian genetics, you're far more likely, clearly, to express the major character traits of the reptilian brain.
Well, it's funny. I had a guest on a few weeks ago who talked about the brain, and there's a portion of the brain, two areas called the amygdala, and he believes that the amygdala, when it flips, either brings you to your creative side of your brain or your reptilian brain.
Right.
And it could very well be that these kinds of people have this amygdala flipped to the reptilian side, maybe all the time.
That's very interesting. I'm not aware of that area. I'd like to know more about
so
that.
So you add science into some of the things you're talking about,
right,
and you might be onto something.
Well, certainly, just to finish the point, there are lots of other character traits, like an obsession with top-down hierarchical structures, an obsession with might is right, an obsession with territoriality, as the scientists put it. This is mine, keep out. This all comes from the reptilian brain. But then, interestingly, going on to the point, this is where I'm coming from, where you mentioned about having so much money and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I read an article, very interesting article, in the Los Angeles Times, which was about what he called the cult of excess in Southern California. In other words, people having more and more and more than they need. It was talking about the fact that the basic size of plate in restaurants had got bigger in the last little while in that area and what have you, and that it was more and more and more, and the more was invariably what was not needed, or even if you looked at it, not even wanted. So what was this? And they quoted at length this French anthropologist who was saying that this desire for excess, this desire for far more than we need, comes from, he said, the reptilian brain. They are complex. And he said, for this reason, he said, the reptilian brain is about survival. It's absolutely obsessed with survival. And when you talk to people who work with, reptilian animals like crocodiles and stuff, I have in Australia and places, they say that the whole of the instinct of these animals is with survival, everything. It's all based on that. And what this guy was saying in the article is that the reptilian brain equates having far more than necessary with a greater chance of survival. It's almost like stockpiling food. Oh, I feel better now. I've got a better chance of survival.
Yeah, I've got a mountain size of food here.
Yeah, so basically what he's saying is this desire for more and more and more, and the society that reflects that, is actually the reptilian brain trying to assure and make itself feel better that it actually is going to survive. And this is interesting because if you go back to what we were talking about earlier, according to this idea of the interspace plane and the fact that these entities are feeding off human energy, and that's their energy source, the fear of not surviving would be very great. And what would frighten you more than anything in that situation is anyone that was bringing about harmony, peace, and an end to fear. And when you look at it, I mean, we talked earlier about visionaries and what have you and people that are saying different things. Why is it that through the centuries and people today, those that talk about bringing about peace and wanting peace and harmony and an end to conflict and an end to war and all this stuff, they are targeted. You're not patriotic. You're against war. What? Unpatriotic because you don't want people to die? I mean, excuse me. But they get targeted because the peace and harmony brings an end to the energy flow that these guys live off. And so fear of surviving is the fear of harmony coming to the world we live in.
Did not the late Princess Di strongly believe that the queen mother might have been reptilian?
Well, what's interesting is in a book called The Biggest Secret, where I talk about this in relation to Diana, I quote a friend of hers who I talked to at length, and what she told me in terms of theme and some of the detail is precisely what this butler, Paul Burrell, has come out in his book recently, all these years later. The story was this, George. I was in America in 1997, and I'd kind of heard this reptilian thing earlier in the 90s, about the mid-90s, and you put it on the back burner. I'm not sure about that. I don't know about that. And you get on with your life, because at that time I was researching the 5 cents level of this, the banking scam, the political scam, the creating problems to offer solutions to change society, all that. But from 97, I was in America, and in a period of 15 days, I met, in different parts of America, so I was traveling around talking, I met 12 different people from completely different walks of life who told me the same story of seeing people, often in positions of power, though not always, transforming in front of their eyes from a human form into a reptilian form and then back again.
David, we were talking about Princess Diana, and you were relating some stories that you had heard.
Yeah, what happened was that after this period I mentioned before the break of meeting all these different people in America telling me the same story about shape-shifting reptilians, of course, I wasn't going to talk about this publicly because, you know, what was going on here? But then I came back to England, and I got an invite to go to the House of Lords here to talk to about three members of the House of Lords in the Houses of Parliament in London who knew this conspiracy was going on and wanted to talk to me about it. And when I was there, there was a lady who was also there who was saying some very, very interesting things about Princess Diana, who had not long died in Paris. This was in 97. And afterwards, I said to the lady, hey, you know, how do you know this stuff? She said, well, my best friend is Princess Diana's closest confidant on these esoteric stuff that you're talking about. And she said, I think I can get her to talk to you. And she did. She hadn't talked to anyone else, but a friend persuaded her. And she came over to talk to me. I talked to her for hours. Her name's Christine Fitzgerald, who was acknowledged by the media here as a close friend of Diana. Mm-hmm. She's a hands-on healer and an alternative healer. And Diana used to go to her for alternative healing and stuff, which Diana was into. And she told me about the fact that people who had sympathy with her from within the intelligence community, like MI5 in Britain, had warned Diana that there were plots against her. All the stuff that has come out with this Burrell book recently, and the letter that she gave to him, which said that she felt there was a plan to kill her in a car crash. But in the middle of this conversation, again, I emphasize, I hadn't talked to her or anyone else about this whole reptilian thing that had come into my life. In the middle of this conversation, she said to me, do you know what Diana's nickname for the Windsors was? I said, no. She said she used to call them the lizards or the reptiles.
Oh.
She used to say, in all seriousness, they're not human. And I thought, oh, my goodness, not reptiles again. What's happening to me? So I said, playing the idiot. I said, what do you mean reptiles? What are you talking about? What do you mean?
Yeah.
And she said, because this Christine works with other members of the aristocracy as well who come to her healing center. And she said, you know that the royal family is a reptilian-human hybrid. They're not the same as us.
It's incredible.
And she talked to me about, the very story that I have confirmed from so many different areas since, that there was an interbreeding which created a hybrid bloodline. This is where, quote, royalty came from, why they're obsessed with genetics,
mm-hmm.
and that these people have the ability to move between human and reptilian form. And she said Diana was aware that they weren't human. And interestingly, what she told me, and I've come across some other stuff recently that has led me the same way, that what was happening is that if the reptilian genetics, because of the interbreeding, gets too reptilian, then they simply can't hold human form because the DNA flips.
Right.
So they said that when they've gone so far along interbreeding with themselves, they have to bring in human genes to stop the rundown to not holding human form.
Mm-hmm.
And she said and people can see in my books over the years, one of the things that these reptilian bloodlines are obsessed with is blonde-haired, blue-eyed people, which seems to be very much part of the process I've just described. And this Christine Fitzgerald was pointing out that they interbred with her because they needed an infusion of those genes to stop this rundown to too much reptilian genetics. And when you read books that have been written about Diana with her, not just approval, but with her input to the writer, she says that once the children were born, William and Harry, that's the point where it was like, okay, don't want you anymore. And that's when the process started of pushing her out. And what Christine was telling me is that this, and this has been confirmed now ever since, that this relationship between Camilla Parker Bowles and Prince Charles
mm-hmm.
Was going on, never ended.
Never ended, no.
And the reason they brought Diana in, even though Charles didn't want it, was because they needed that infusion of genetics. And now what do we have? We have William, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy. And One of the interesting other aspects of this is that these people, like I said earlier, are obsessed with ritual days, and they're obsessed with the cycles of the sun in relation to the earth. So the summer solstice is a real big day for them. In one of the books that had Diana's input, she says that what happened was that they told her she was going to be induced when she was giving birth to William. And when she asked why, she was told because we need the birth to synchronize with Prince Charles's polo playing program. Now, I mean, what does it say if that was true about Prince Charles? Hey, just induce the wife, will you? Give her some drugs and stuff and my child, and because I don't want it to ruin my polo brain, but
yeah,
I've got a game.
I've got a game coming.
In fact, however, that was just a story for Diana, because what the inducement achieved was that William was born on the summer solstice, which is a major, a significant symbolic day for them going back into the ancient world. So, like I say, I talk for hours to Christine Fitzgerald, and in The Biggest Secret, I detail what she said at length, but certainly she was that's what she said to me, and it synchronizes with what I've learned from other areas, too.
What do they think of you in England, David? I mean, do they welcome you with open arms, or do they suppress you out there?
Well, put it this way: when I wrote Alice in Wonderland of the World Trade Center Disaster, and the subtitle on the front of the book is "Why the Official Story of 9/11 is a Monumental Lie," if that dropped on your desk as a newspaper or radio news program, you're going to pick it up, even if you think, "Hey, this is kind of wild." it's not really; it's common sense, but this is kind of wild. But hey, we'll ring this guy. Let's talk to him. Let's read this book and see what he's saying. The book was sent to every single newspaper in Britain, every major television and radio program in Britain, and not one single one did a single word upon it. And the same happened in America, where it went to every major newspaper and every major mainstream television and radio program that would in any way be interested in that story. Not a single phone call, not one, hey, how do you come to this conclusion? Nothing. And there's two ways that I'm seen in Britain. One is as a complete nutter, which I take as almost a medal of honor, because in this crazy world, if this crazy world sees you as sane, then it's time to ask why and what you're doing. And in the other side, increasingly, I'm seen with emerging and very rapidly emerging credibility, not least because things that I was talking about and writing about years ago are now happening. I spoke in London the last time I spoke in Britain, and the best part of 2,000 people turned up, including, incidentally, Noel Gallagher of Oasis. I noticed you played one of their songs earlier.
Right.
I like your choice of music, by the way.
Thanks.
Very good. So that's the thing. And the difference between the two, George, is one, he's a nutter. Have you read what he's saying in his books? No, but he's a nutter. Reptile, you're a nutter. And then the other side, those that are looking at this and coming to an increasing understanding that, hey, there is something in this, are those that have actually bothered to find out what I'm saying.
Let's peek for a moment through the looking glass together, David, with what's going on in, let's say, in Iraq right now. We have not found weapons of mass destruction, whether he moved them out to the Baqa Valley between Lebanon and Syria or not remains to be seen. The point is, they haven't found the weapons of mass destruction, which was really the focal point for why Tony Blair and George Bush decided to convince their respective countries to go in and do what they had to do. Aside from the fact that I truly believe Saddam Hussein was a butcher and apparently did some incredibly horrendous things to his people, the issue is, though, is how two nations may have been deceived in order to go in and do whatever they had to do with what is beginning to become obvious that there's some other motives here. And
well, yes, George, it's a very good point, and I could talk for 3 hours on this. If I could get one thing out of the way, it's very important. It's the way that we are manipulated in many ways is by having a monster figure like Saddam Hussein to focus on. He is bad, we must do something about it, black and white. With the Illuminati, it is never black and white. It's always a shade of gray. So on the one hand, yes, you had a man in Saddam Hussein who they still haven't found, just like Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
Just a coincidence, nothing to worry about. And you had a man who was doing horrendous things. He was gassing the Kurds, and he was involved in that horrendous war against Iran.
I believe it was our gas, by the way, though, wasn't it?
Exactly where I'm going. Now, this is where we have to get away from the black and white and start looking at shades of gray. One of the greatest techniques, in fact, the greatest technique of mass mind and emotional manipulation is this one I call problem-reaction-solution. You want to change society or do something, but if you suggested it openly, you would get an adverse reaction. So you don't do it openly. You play problem-reaction-solution. Stage one, you covertly create a problem. Stage two, you tell the public through the media, unquestioning media, the version of the problem you want them to believe, i.e. Saddam did it or Osama bin Laden did it. And then you want the public to say, something must be done, this can't go on, what are you going to do about it? And that allows you to play the sting at stage three, which is offering the solutions to the problems you've created. So problems and perceived problems are vital to the advancement of this agenda for centralized global control. And so they had to invent a problem. The problem was the mantra of weapons of mass destruction. However, as has come out in State Department documents towards the end of 2002, and indeed there are pictures of the meeting, in 1983, it was Donald Rumsfeld, the current defense secretary, who was sent to Baghdad by the Reagan-Bush administration to organize the shipment of biological and chemical weapons, including bubonic plague, this is in the State Department document, to Saddam Hussein to be used against the Iranians in the Iran-Iraq war, and that was the stuff that was used to create to gas the Kurds.
Which, by the way, he denies, yet there's a picture of him shaking hands with Saddam Hussein.
Exactly.
Which, by the way, was not altered. It's not one of those things where they put a cutout of Donald Rumsfeld next to Saddam. The two of them were actually together in Baghdad.
Exactly. And, like I say, these State Department documents that were released in 2002 confirmed the meeting took place. Now, again with Donald Rumsfeld, and again we're coming back and holding this theme of the weapons of mass destruction and why they've not been found. What is happening is what I call in Tales from the Time Loop the two-track technique. On one level, you have a secret agenda in which you want to change the face of the world so that you have a world government, world central bank, world army, world currency and a microchip population connected to the global positioning satellite. These things need to unfold. Now, you want to hide the fact, A, that there is this agenda of the Big Brother global society, and B, you also need at the same time to provide the excuses to introduce it. So on one level, you've got that secret agenda, and on another level, running side by side, you have what I call the movie, which is the version of reality that people are given to A, hide the agenda, and B, justify its introduction. So when the agenda demands the invasion of Iraq, the movie has to produce the excuse, which is weapons of mass destruction. This is how it works. And so what you find, and I've researched this all these years, is the same people over and over that are saying this is the problem and this is why what we have to do about it are the same people who are involved in providing the problem in the first place, i.e., the weapons of mass destruction were provided by Britain and America to Iraq. But it goes further than that. Of course, one of the baddies now is North Korea. Well, why are they baddies? Why are they a danger? Hey, they have nuclear technology. Okay, well, where did they get it from? Ah, stands back in amazement. In the year 2000, a European engineering giant called ABB sold that nuclear technology to North Korea. And on the board of ABB for 11 years, and at that time, was a man called Donald Rumsfeld.
Oh, yes.
Now defense secretary, saying, North Korea's got this technology. We must do something about it. This is the way the game works.
Now, well, here's the question, though. I'm confused over the game. They first give it, and then they want to take it away. Why?
Because they wanted to provide it, because they wanted to have Saddam use it, A, against the Iranians in the Iran-Iraq war, which was orchestrated on both sides, and both sides were armed by the same people.
But all along, they knew they were going to use it to come and get him later.
Yeah, and they want him to use what they give, because then they can say he uses chemical weapons. See, I've talked to people on the inside about this, and what they describe is, they say this agenda, when you see it, and parts of it are actually written down, they describe it as like a biorhythm chart, where one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. So the invasion of Iraq, as with 9/11, was not orchestrated months in advance. It was orchestrated years and even decades in advance, because there is a certain sequence of events that they're playing. And indeed, I don't know whether you've come across this, but there is a document that actually was produced for the Bush administration by the people currently in control of the Bush administration in September 2000 by an organization set up by people like Rumsfeld and Cheney called the Project for the New American Century, which lays out, before Bush was even elected or non-elected, the agenda that they wish to follow. And what does it talk about? It talks about using the excuse of Saddam Hussein in Iraq to go into Iraq, get a foothold in the Middle East, and from that point, then start taking over other countries. Who are these countries it names here? I've got it in front of me. Oh, it talks about North Korea, Syria, Iran. Now, the people behind this report...
All countries, though, hostile to us, right?
Well, the point being that we were told, George, that when the Bush administration came to power, they found out that there was this problem with Iraq, and something had to be done. Or, indeed, that came after 9/11. Sometime into the Bush administration, they suddenly discover, hey, Iraq's a problem, weapons of mass destruction. As if we must do something about it, we've just found out. Well, clearly from this document, it was planned to do that before they even came to power. And when you have... the axis of evil speech that Bush delivered, calling Iraq, North Korea, and Iran the axis of evil, that was actually written by a guy called David Froom, who was a speechwriter for Bush at that time, who is connected to the very same people who produced this document. People like Richard Pearl, who's known as the String of Pearls, or the people around him are known as the String of Pearls because he controls them so fundamentally. Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, the Deputy Defense Secretary, all involved in the production of this report. And then we're told, oh, no, we just found out Iraq's a problem. We've got to do something. We're going to try to negotiate. We don't intend to invade. When all along, even before they came to power, that's exactly what they did. And in Britain here, there is a lady called Claire Short. She was the International Development Secretary in the Blair cabinet and resigned after the invasion of Iraq because she realized that what she and the cabinet had been told by Blair was a pack of lies. And she's actually gone public. This is a woman that sat next to Blair in cabinet meetings and said it is very clear that Bush and Blair made the decision to invade Iraq at least as early as the fall of 2002. And yet in the months that followed that, oh no, we're going to try to negotiate through the UN and all this stuff. This is the movie, George, unfolding to hide the agenda, which was they were going to invade Iraq at that time for a long time before they actually did.
And now we're there. We just signed a bill for $87.5 billion to start constructing something we tore apart.
Yeah, exactly. And as I talk about in Tales from the Time Loop, George, the people and companies that control the companies that provided the weaponry to bomb Iraq are the same people who are controlling the companies who are getting the contracts to control Iraq.
That is absolutely true. You are
including Cheney's Halliburton that now controls Iraqi oil.
There is no doubt about that. What you say is true. David, this controlling group, the so-called Illuminati, how many people do you think involved in it?
Well, the real people, George, that are running the show, you never see, because if you don't want people to know what's behind something, then you don't put yourself on public display. So when you get to the level of presidents and prime ministers, you're still some way down from the peak of the pyramid. The real power is in those shadowy areas that control those people. And what we are misled by is the belief that, for instance, the President of the United States is running the United States, or the Prime Minister of Britain is running the Britain, or the head of the World Bank is running the World Bank. These are levels of I almost might describe them as administrators of bringing this agenda into reality, but the agenda itself is being orchestrated at much higher levels of the pyramid than them, and they are placed into power on the understanding that that is what they will do, otherwise they don't come into power. I mean, you just look at running for president in the United States now, you need fantastic cuckoo land amounts of money just to try to get the nomination from your own party to actually run for president. I mean, you're off the Richter scale. And it's no accident that George W. Bush has broken all records in raising money when he was running for president, and will probably do the same the next time. It's because these people are selected, not elected. I mean, if you are in a country where you're given the choice between two people, both of which are acceptable to this group, what kind of choice is that? Which mask on the same face do you want to be president? You know, I mean, this is the way it works.
They cover their bases, don't they?
Yeah, and the other thing, George, if we look at this, there's 280 million people, I think, in America at the moment. If you go back to the Declaration of Independence and the first president, George Washington, in 1789, you would think that the vastly a greater number of people, even than the 280 million now, would reflect the people as a whole, in the sense that one of the great glorious things about America is that the people come from such a wonderfully diverse genetic pool, genetic background from all over the world.
Yes.
It makes it a wonderful, wonderful, diverse place. Now, if it is true that anyone can become president of the United States, which is one of the things I hear as confirmation that it's a free country, then why does the presidential lineup from George Washington to George W. Bush, 43 presidents, why does it read genetically, overwhelmingly, like a royal dynasty in Europe? Why does it not reflect the glorious diversity of the American people? Because it is not a situation where the president is elected. This one certainly wasn't in Florida. They are selected, and they are placed into power to bring about certain things. And if they don't, then they're removed.
Well, there's no doubt about that. As a matter of fact, if you go down and look at all the elected presidents that we've had, most of them have come from high society. You're aware of the Skull and Bones, of course, from Yale University. There's a handful from there.
Possibly, where the next election, if John Kerry wins the Democratic nomination, we'll have a Skull and Bones initiate against a Skull and Bones initiate.
I don't think a middle-class American can ever get elected president, do you?
The question is, are they of the bloodline, and or are they willing to do as they're told and bring changes into a society that suit the agenda? If the answer to either of those questions is no, they've got no chance of being president under the present system.
Let's go to the phones. You ready, David?
Yes, mate.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi there.
Yes, sir.
Good morning.
Yeah.
I've got a somewhat intricate question to ask about bloodlines. I can trace my direct lineage back 500 years. We have had many close scrapes with success, and there's seemingly some glass ceiling, if you want to call it that. I guess my question is, how deep in the minutia of everyday life does this group actually get involved? My bloodline, when we came to America, owned a large portion of Manhattan and then suddenly just didn't own it for some reason and moved off to upstate New York. We've had one of my relatives was the captain of the Arizona, who was the only ship captain that was killed in that attack. It just seems like, well, I guess the question is, how deeply involved in the minutia, and do they actually have bloodlines that at one point did not cooperate and are now blacklisted, so to speak?
I think, to be honest, in the great infinity of possibility, all those things can happen. One thing I would emphasize, and this is what a few of the insiders have told me, which is very, very relevant, I think, to what you've just said, is that this DNA corruption will lie dormant until it's activated. And there will be people who go through their lives with this DNA corruption who will not be affected by it in any way. But what I'm told is that it's overwhelmingly activated by these rituals that they put people through in the secret society networks. Now, as I've said in the books, if you look at, for instance, the Freemasons, the overwhelming vast majority of Freemasons will not be involved in what I'm talking about. It's just a gentleman's club to many of them, but they still go through various initiation rituals, which they don't really understand. Oh, I've got to learn this stuff. Oh, it's just kind of tradition, I suppose it is, and all that stuff, so I better go through it or I can't get in. But what's happening, as I understand it, is that these rituals are created to, among those that really know, to create a vibrational frequency that will activate this DNA, not necessarily immediately, but slowly tease it open and activate it. And once it's activated, then this possession can take place. And when you're dealing with rituals at the level of what has become known as Satanism, where they get into the real deal stuff and start bringing entities out of the ether into this reality, then that's when this stuff can really be activated. And interestingly, I was talking to a guy who had heard me speak, and he was in the financial area, and he called me and he said, could you tell me anything about the Knights of Malta? I said, well, at least at the top level of them, keep well away from them. I said, why? He said, they just offered me a job with a lot of money at the IMF out of nowhere, and they've asked me to come to Vegas and meet them.
Vegas?
And I said, well, you know, you could go along out of interest, but be very careful, because, you know, they will in some way know that your bloodline. Do you know about your bloodline? She said, well, funnily enough, he said, my father left me at an early age, and I've just been reunited with him, and I've just found out he works for the CIA and has done all along. I had no idea. I said, well, be careful, I said, because this is one of the scenarios that I've been told about. They target people who have the bloodline, but are not aware of it, and it's not activated, this DNA part of it. And what they'll do, as I understand it, is once you get in there, they'll invite you to take part in various rituals and secret society stuff, which will activate it. He said they already have. He said, I've been invited to go to this ritual he talked about, this secret society meeting, as part of this deal. And what happened was that he, as a result of what he heard from me, didn't take the job. And soon afterwards, in the months that followed, his financial business was destroyed. So, you know, they don't like people that say no to them. So there's a lot of people with this DNA, but it's not activated, and they go through life without knowing about it, and unless it's activated, which is what they do when they target people.
Do you think JFK was involved in this group?
He's bound to have been of the bloodline, because the Kennedy family is one of these elite Eastern establishment families. However, like I say, there's all possibility. And in the end, we're talking about DNA. But really, the real power within the human entity is consciousness. Now, everything is conscious. The DNA is conscious. Everything is consciousness. We're all one consciousness expressing itself in different ways. But the power of the person's consciousness can overcome this DNA. And therefore, even though they have it, the power of the consciousness, the if you like, coming from the heart center, can overcome that. And you can not fall to this possession, and you cannot fall to this agenda, and you can want to do something different with it. And if you get in a position of power and start to manifest this, your own consciousness, rather than following the agenda and the manipulation, then of course they want rid of you, and they want rid of you fast. And that is highly likely what happened to Kennedy.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with David Icke. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. We're doing well.
David, it's an honor to talk with you.
Yeah, good.
I just finished reading your book, The Biggest Secret, and the way I'm kind of down about it, because the way I see it is that this brotherhood is in every single facet of our society. It seems to me like they've already won. They've won this, you know, agenda. And I'm wondering, can we get out of this?
Absolutely, we can. And I tell you why. I've had some amazing experiences in the last year, And one of them was in Brazil in January of 2003. What actually happened was that when I wrote this book, Alice in Wonderland, the World Trade Center Disaster, when I'd finished it, I said to myself, I said to my wife, you know, if I'm going to take this story on and I'm going to know more about the bigger picture beyond which I understand now, I'm going to have to go in awareness to these some of these other dimensions and see what goes on there and see this world from there. And synchronistically, a common word tonight, I got an invite very shortly after that to go to Brazil, to the Amazon rainforest, with a group and to take part in an event in which people on four occasions, I only did it twice, took something called ayahuasca, which is a plant substance which shaman in South America have been using to take people into other levels of awareness for a long time. So I thought, well, I'm going to give this a try because I need to go out of this dimension in awareness if I'm going to take this story on. And what actually happened was I went into an altered state, which is quite interesting, because when you closed your eyes, you were in a completely different world, and when you opened your eyes, you were in the five-sense world. It was very interesting comparing the two. And I went into a place that I can only describe as utter, utter bliss. Nothing vibrated. It was just total stillness, and I was everything that existed. I was self-aware, but also everything else, and everything else was me. And for about 5 hours, I had this female voice, as loud as mine is now, talking to me, giving me an explanation in very profound and simple terms, which I detail in Time Loop, of the nature of reality and how we create it. And it pointed out that everything that we're experiencing is actually an illusion, a dream, and we can change it any time we want. But fundamental to that is understanding how we're creating it and why we're creating it and how we can change it from a prison to a paradise. And what it said to me was, this is all you really need to remember. Infinite love is the only truth. Everything else is illusion. And what it was saying put another way is, the fact that everything is one infinite consciousness is the only truth. Everything else is the imagination of that consciousness, the dreams of that consciousness, and the nightmares of that consciousness. And it was pointing out that this reality that we're experiencing, this five-sense world, what some people call this matrix, is actually a thought form. And when we accept the thought form, we constantly reinforce it. And therefore, we are thinking this whole thing into existence, and we're holding it in our reality by believing in it. And it said that this whole Illuminati and all this manipulation, it can be dreamed out of existence because it's an illusion. Everything's an illusion. And what was interesting then is I came back from Brazil and with all this 5 hours of information, and I thought, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the scientific stuff and the experimentation and the quantum physics, and I'm going to see if anything's come up that backs this up. Because one of the things this voice said was, the world you live in is a holographic illusion. It's a hologram. It's not actually real, and it's only going on in your minds. It's not actually going on outside of yourself where you think you're looking at it. And what was fantastic is, when I looked at the scientific stuff, it was unbelievable confirmation, which I didn't realize until I started looking at it. For instance, we talk about the fact that we saw it with our own eyes as if that's what we see, but we don't. I didn't realize that when information actually enters the eye, A, it's upside down, and B, it's two-dimensional. As it passes through the brain, it only becomes a three-dimensional world that we think we're existing in when it hits the visual cortex in the brain. The brain flips it upside down and turns it into a three-dimensional image. Not only that, as experimentation has shown, as that information makes its journey from the eye through the brain to the visual cortex, before it hits the cortex where it manifests as a three-dimensional world that we think we live in, up to and sometimes more than 50% of what enters the eyes is changed and edited, stuff taken out and stuff put in that isn't there. And this editing process takes place on the basis of belief. which is exactly what we were talking about with George earlier about the stage hypnotist. The stage hypnotist is implanting a false belief, and therefore the brain edits its reality on the basis of what it has been manipulated to believe is real. So what we're looking at with this apparently all-controlling force is they have implanted a belief in us to accept a certain reality that allows this manipulation to proceed. Once we disconnect ourselves from that reality and create our own and see beyond it, suddenly the manifestation of that, i.e. the control, also gets thought out of existence because it's an illusion as much as everything else is. And just a very quick point is to illustrate what I'm saying. I read an excellent book. I mean, many people listening to this show have come across it, I'm sure, called The Holographic Universe by a guy called Michael Tolbert.
Right, right.
And he tells a story in there, which he actually experienced. He said that his father organized a party for friends, and he got a hypnotist along, a professional hypnotist, to do party tricks. And he got people to believe there was an elephant in the room and all this stuff. But the point of the story, from this explanation's point of view, is this. He had a guy called Tom, and he put him into a hypnotic state. And he got him to eat a potato while he thought it was an apple. Why did it taste like an apple when it's a potato? Because the planted belief that it was an apple was in his brain, so his five senses turned it into an apple in terms of taste. This is what's going on all the time. And what happened was that as he was bringing him out of the trance, he said to Tom, look, when I bring you out of this hypnotic state, you're not going to be able to see your daughter in the room. And what he did then was led his daughter to stand right in front of this guy. This guy was sitting down, so he's looking in the midriff of his daughter. And he came out of the hypnotic state, or apparently did, and the hypnotist said, can you see your daughter in the room? And he said, he looked around, he said, no. His daughter starts giggling. He's still not sussed it. He's looking around, he can't see his daughter. He's looking into her stomach. The hypnotist then went behind the daughter and pushed something against the small of her back and said to Tom, what am I holding in my hand? And he said, you're holding a watch. He said, there's an inscription on it. Can you read it? He leaned forward. He read the inscription. Between him and the watch is his daughter.
Amazing.
Now, from the perspective of the conditioned reality, that is impossible. But it's not when you understand how we create reality.
All right, stay with us, David.
The belief was the daughter did not exist in the room, and therefore the information which carried the daughter came through the eyes. The brain in that belief system edited her out before it hit the visual cortex and manifested as the room he thought was all around him. Now, what's happening, George, is we are having implanted beliefs all the time, as we talked about earlier, and we are doing that editing process. We can change this world in an instant when we change our sense of reality.
David Icke, my guest, as we make the final turn here with your phony calls as well. Let's go to our phone. I almost said phony calls, David. Phone calls.
No.
Let's go to Susan. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air. Hi, Susan.
Hi there, George.
Yeah.
I had a couple of questions for your guest.
Sure, he is there, listening, ready to go.
Okay, David?
Oh, Susan, yeah.
Are you saying that you think the U.S. government was responsible for 9/11? This is my first question.
Right. Well, again, it's very important that we realize that when people say it's the government, it's the Freemasons, they're actually missing the point, because there are vast, vast numbers of people in the U.S. government pyramid. The vast, overwhelming majority, as with Freemasons, who have no idea what is actually happening in their organization and would be appalled if they knew. I'm not saying it's the U.S. government. I'm saying it is this force which calls itself the Illuminati, which works through the structure of U.S. government by placing its placemen and its gophers in positions of apparent power, and through them orchestrates events that will advance the agenda. So if you look at the pyramid of the CIA, people say all the time, it's the CIA. Well, there's vast numbers of people in the CIA who genuinely think they're serving their country. It's not the CIA. It's that force which controls the CIA and dictates its policy. And if there's one force, for instance, that is ultimately controlling the FBI and the White House and the CIA and the National Security Agency, then these apparently unconnected groups can be used to bring about the same end. They can orchestrate something like 9/11, and at the same time they can orchestrate the cover-up of what has actually been behind it coming out. So it's this force, not the government.
Okay. And then my second question is, sorry, but I got to ask this. How do we know that you aren't one of the shape-shifting reptilians?
Well, I guess you can ask that.
Who is maybe manipulating our minds?
Of course you can ask that. And I'll tell you what, more than you can ask that, you should be asking that. You should be questioning all things. That's why I said in the show earlier, if anyone reads my books and says I agree with every word of that, I'm the most disappointed man in the place, because what I'm doing is I'm putting out an alternative set of information, an alternative explanation for what's going on in the world, if you like, an alternative reality. But it doesn't have to be everyone else's reality. It's just an alternative to the one that they're currently receiving, drip by drip, second by second. And they should let it go through what you might call their own truth detector to see what parts of it feel right to them and which they accept and which they don't. And not only don't I care how people receive my information and what bits they accept and what bits they don't, it's actually none of my business. My business is putting it out. How people receive it is none of my business. It's only theirs. So I'm at peace if people say, load of rubbish, mate, or if they say, yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. It's not about persuading people of something. It's about giving an alternative to the reality they're receiving all the time. So, yeah, absolutely people should not accept everything that I say just because I say it if it doesn't feel right to them.
You know, I've always believed that Osama bin Laden was a hired hitman in this 9/11 horrible tragedy, that some organization, some group, for whatever reason, brought him in, and he and his al-Qaeda network, much like the old James Bond movies, David, were brought in to do a dastardly deed.
The thing is, George, I'm not saying that Osama bin Laden grouping was not in any way involved in 9/11. I'm saying they weren't by any means or nothing like, if they were involved, the prime orchestrators. I mean, I talked to a guy called Andreas von Bülow, who was the defense minister in Germany and also was involved in other ministries that related to the intelligence community. And he actually wrote a book which translates as In the Name of the State, about the German intelligence community, the intelligence network in Germany, because when he became defense minister, he realized that they knew more about some of the foreign intelligence agencies than they knew about their own.
Mm-hmm.
And he also realized something that I've been saying in my books for years, that when you get to the peak of the CIA and the peak of German intelligence and the peak of Mossad and the peak of British intelligence, you're basically looking at the same organization answering to the same masters. I mean, the division and diversity is only kind of there at the lower levels, not where the real decisions are made. And what he told me in a long telephone conversation, indeed he's gone public in German newspapers with it, is there is absolutely no way in the world that 9/11 could have been orchestrated without the involvement of at least one major intelligence network. Could not have been done otherwise. Not just the way it was done, but also the way that there was a lack of reaction to it.
And maybe a rogue unit within?
Well, you could call it a rogue unit, but that could easily be what I've just described, George.
That's true.
This force working through these agencies.
That's true.
I mean, look at what's happened in America with these FBI agents, where they've actually gone public and said, hold on a minute, we were stopped by the FBI in Washington from investigating what we were doing, investigating terrorist links.
Or we notified you. We let you know. We sent memos, and nobody did anything about it.
Yeah, so, I mean, there was a guy in the time of the Kennedy period who worked in special operations and that kind of area called Leroy Fletcher Prouty. And he came out with a wonderful phrase which sums up 9/11, but he was talking about assassinations, but the same thing applies. He said this: assassinations don't just happen, they are allowed to happen. And if you want to find people who were involved in an assassination, find out who had the ability to call off the normal security reaction and protection at the right time, and took the opportunity to do that. Now, when you look at the killing of President Kennedy, the killing of Martin Luther King, the killing of Princess Diana, of Rabin in Israel, this absolutely applies every time. Just before, at the time of the assassination, for some reason, the normal level of security for those people was withdrawn. And when you, and I go into this in Alice in Wonderland, the World Trade Center disaster, at considerable length and in great detail, when you look at the non-reaction to those planes after they were hijacked, and the non-reaction to Flight 77, even after the first two had hit the World Trade Center, it is utterly, utterly unexplainable by any normal look at how the reaction is supposed to operate. And we're asked to believe that terrorists who had the target of the Pentagon took off from Washington with the intention of hitting the Pentagon, in the knowledge that NORAD, the military defense organization at Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado that defends North American airspace, Canada and the United States, knowing that you can go on the internet and get their regulations of how they should react, what should happen is the Federal Aviation Administration, at the level of the air traffic control, when they lose contact with a cockpit or a transponder is turned off, they are told to treat it as an emergency and to contact NORAD. NORAD is then supposed to scramble planes to go up there and see what's going on. Of course, you can't have planes flying around crowded airspace with no contact with the ground, so mm-hmm. they need to know. What happened on 9/11 is that that process did not happen. And as someone has pointed out during this investigation into 9/11, there are questions that the FAA should answer but aren't, to explain why it took so long to react. So you have a situation where these highly professional terrorists, so according to the head of the FBI, Mueller, are supposed to be, have orchestrated and planned this for years. They're targeting the Pentagon. They take off from down the road from the Pentagon. They know that this NORAD reaction, what are you going to do? You're going to hijack it as quick as you can and hit the Pentagon. These guys, we're asked to believe, flew this plane out into the Midwest, 45 minutes. They hijacked it and then flew it all the way back. And the biggest headquarters of any military in the world was not defended to the point where a plane could fly 45 minutes, hijacked from the Midwest, and hit the building without any response. Please, this is insane. And when you look at the official story of 9/11, as I show in the book, it's not just that the odd thing doesn't add up. There's not one strand that fits to another. If that statement is true, then that statement has to be untrue. They can't both be true. And so 9/11 is a classic problem-reaction-solution. Create the problem, get the reaction, outrage, fear, do something, offer the solution. Solution, an absolute destruction of basic freedoms and privacy in America and elsewhere, justified by 9/11 and this war on terrorism, which on your news, George Bush is saying today, we are going to win and we're going to do the resources to win. How can you ever win a war on terrorism? How do you ever know that it's won? You can't win it. It's open-ended. Exactly what they want, an open-ended war so they can demonize any country they wish to target and then take it over. And Iraq's just the start unless we wake up.
First-time caller line, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello?
Hello?
Yep, go ahead.
Oh, I enjoy your show, and David, I appreciate your comments, and I'm not sure how far the conversation's moved along, but I was going to ask you if this Illuminati is around there. I've only heard about it a couple of times, but I've been calling it a multinational corporate junta that seems to be pushing around this country, the citizens of this country, as well as many parts of the world. It seems like ever since the 1960s, the powers to be just don't want an educated, somebody affluent, and engaged population running around anymore. And there's been like an attempt to, well, not an attempt, but, you know, as we've outsourced so much of our high-paying jobs, and as we've watched the educational system kind of, you know, drowned in mediocrity, the average American is kind of like becoming a overworked, exhausted, non-engaging element that just chooses to stay home and watch filtered news.
And, you are so right, and for this reason. If you wish to control a mass of people and dictate their reality, the last thing you want is a thinking, healthy, mentally sharp, educated population. That's your worst nightmare, because they're going to start saying, hold on a minute, that doesn't make sense to me, and what about this, and what about that? You want people to be, in the term that I've heard education being described in recent years, dumbed down, because you want to sell a reality that suits your agenda. You don't want people questioning. It's the last thing you want. And so all these things come together. And years ago, in fact, in a book called And the Truth Shall Set You Free, I detail a document that came to light, which was basically a manual for how to mind control and dictate to the mass of the population. And one of the things that it said in there was keep them busy, 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 back on the farm with the other animals. And what you say about the jobs... as I understand it, and certainly it's the same in this country, Americans are now doing 2 and 3 jobs for what used to be the standard of living that one would provide some time ago. And the idea is, of course, that they want people exhausted. They want people to be so focused on surviving another month and meeting the bills.
And just getting by.
They don't lift their heads and look around and see what's going on. They're too busy with their heads down. This is all what they want because... people who look up suddenly go, hold on a minute, I didn't realize it was like that, so keep their heads down. And making them survive with more and more work for the same standard of living is fundamental to that.
It's like a master plan. Who thinks this up?
Well, yeah, I mean, behind the scenes, like I mentioned earlier, above, symbolically in this pyramid, of the people that apparently are in control of the world, like the White House and Downing Street and what have you, is this shadowy group that doesn't put itself on public display. And they have orchestrated this. It's almost like a gigantic computer program, George.
I've said
in one book, I think they do somewhere have a gigantic computer, which is programmed. That if they put in an outcome, the computer will deliver what is necessary to the sequence of events necessary for that outcome, because that's the kind of way that they orchestrate this. And, you know, something like 9/11 was not, even planned years in advance. That date would have been decades in advance. I mean, again, I talked about earlier in the chat about the obsession these people have with symbolism. There's no way that 9/11... of all days, is going to be the day they chose to do that, when 9/11 is, of course, the emergency call number in America.
Right.
Amazing as it may seem to people hearing this for the first time, the level of symbolism and ritual is so enormous that things like that are giveaways for anyone that's researched the obsession they have with
it. Well, and I'll tell you what is a basis for even more puzzlement is the fact that we haven't found the two players that were reportedly involved in all this. I mean, they're like almost as if they got a free ticket to go hide.
Well, yeah, Mullah Omar, Osama bin Laden, we have to go and find him. He's the villain. Then it's Saddam Hussein, and they're just the ones they don't find. And you know, when you start looking at the technology they have, surveillance technology, in the satellite network and stuff like that. I mean, they can read your number plate from space, and they can't find these guys. I mean, what a coincidence. And I've mentioned in my book, I don't think I can find it now in the time we have.
Yeah, I've got 30 seconds for you, because yeah, I do want you to give your number out.
It's from an Airman magazine talking about the fact that from 56,000 feet, the Global Hawk surveillance plane can actually tell you if a plane has just left a runway, because it can tell the heat and cold difference.
Oh, sure.
Where the plane was. And they can't find these guys. Ludicrous.
Absolutely. Get some numbers out for the book, Tales from the Time Loop.
For the book, it's and it's out literally now, just off the presses, 888-609-5006, 888-609-5006. And if you go into either your website and then through to mine, or direct to mine, davidicke.com, you can order it online and you get it within literally within a few days.
Great. Are you on Amazon.com with the books, David?
Yeah, but it's the website is the best place
That's
to get them.
That's the quickest way to do it, too.
Absolutely.
All right, David, thank you. You do make all of us open up our minds a little bit more.
It's been a real pleasure, George.
All right, you take care of yourself.
Thanks, mate. Bye.
All of you still on hold. Sorry, got to run. Our next Coast to Coast, though, we will have open lines for you on our Friday and the Saturday night program. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM for Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, webmaster Barbara Simpson, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. See you. Be careful.